That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient. Comfortable. Ah.
It's Totally 80s, the podcast dedicated to the music of the greatest decade ever. So, turn up your Walkman, loosen that scrunchie, and get ready to talk 80s with your host, Lindsay Parker.
Hi, I'm Lindsay Parker from Yahoo Entertainment, and welcome to another episode of Totally 80s. We love hearing from you, so why not take a second to follow us at Totally 80s on Facebook and Instagram, or email us your comments and show ideas to podcast@totally80s.com. And just a reminder, if you want to see our fabulous faces, you can also catch this episode on video on our Totally 80s YouTube channel. So go check that out. So I'm real excited about this conversation today. I did not have this on my 2022 bingo card, but the hottest artist of 2022 is Kate Bush, a very happy development, more than 37 years in the making, thanks to Stranger Things and apparently Winona Ryder, who I've heard was pushing for Kate's 1985 single, Running Up That Hill, to be featured on Stranger Things for years. The song, Against All Odds, has gone to number one in multiple countries. It has set all sorts of chart records for Kate, including making her the oldest female artist to have a U.S. number one. She beat out a record that had been held for many years by Cher's Believe. Sorry, Cher. Kate Bush is number one now. Of course, there's much, much, much more to Kate Bush and her discography than Running Up That Hill. So it's time to take a deep dive into that discography and her legacy with my two Kate Bush experts for the day. First joining me is author and NPR music critic Ann Powers, one of the most respected voices in music journalism today, or any day, and the writer of the recent eloquent essay, How Kate Bush's The Dreaming Made My Monsters My Own. Welcome to the show, Ann.
Thank you so much for having me. Always here to talk Kate.
I know. I'm really excited to get all your thoughts because I love that essay. And also joining us today is a rising recording artist and an icon from RuPaul's Drag Race UK, someone who loves Kate so much they have her name tattooed on their knuckles, I believe, memorably dressed as Kate Bush for Drag Race UK's British Gay Icon Runway Challenge, one of my favorite runway challenges ever. It's Ginny Lemon.
Well, hiya, Babs. How are you doing? I'm so excited to be here. Happy Kate-mas.
I know. Happy Kate Day to us all. So I'm just going to dive right into it because, like I said, there's so much to unpack. As I mentioned, all this sort of came about, this resurgence of Kate. Not that she needed a resurgence in our lives, but, you know, on a global scale because of Stranger Things. And Stranger Things obviously has lots of 80s music, and the show has moved the needle in previous times to a lesser degree for other songs like, you know, Lamal's Never Ending Story got a bit of a bump from the show, I remember. But why this song to this degree? I don't think it, I mean, obviously it was in a really amazing scene. I don't know if you guys seen it, but it's, I think it's more than that. Like, why do you think this resonates so much? Why the timing was right for this Kate Bush resurgence to happen?
Well, you know, Running Up That Hill is a song that operates on so many different levels. And there's a backstory that we can talk about, or kind of the quote unquote real story of the lyrics. But the essential message of the song is about resilience. You know, it's about we're reaching, we're stumbling back. It's like that myth of Sisyphus. And let's just talk about the state of the world. We're all feeling that now. So I really think it's that anthemic message at the core of the song that made it resonate with so many people.
Interesting. I grew up in Los Angeles where K-Rock played it all the time. To me, it was a hit. I'm kind of surprised that there are a lot of people who weren't already familiar with the song, even people my own age. Ginny, do you remember where you were when you first heard Running Up That Hill? Does the song resonate with you in that way?
Oh, I mean, absolutely. I think the first time I would have heard it would have been my sister, who used to always play Kate records to me. And I remember kind of, I was always very particular about how I listen to things. So I like to think, listen to things, you know, the first album, then the second and the third and then the fourth. So it wasn't kind of after the dreaming, my mind had been blown. So when it came to The Hounds of Love and Running Up That Hill, obviously the whole album is just filled with bangers. It's so like banger after banger after banger. And I think the reason it probably resurged so much this year was probably because of the overall theme of the show and the music that we're hearing at the moment. It's got that sort of 80s dark pop kind of, you know, no one's really quite doing it well, but it's got that sound. And I think Kate kind of epitomizes that sort of, I hate the word dark pop, but that dark pop sound that the kind of, that the kids are craving for, you know, it's kind of, instead of going for this formulaic, reductive version, you go straight to the source, which is the Kate song, you know, kind of go to the core. And I think probably within that message and what the show was trying to achieve, it kind of struck a lot of people. And I tell you, the most amazing thing for me is the young people that have responded to it. I've started singing that song within my sets at Pride, kind of across the UK. And the amount of young people, that's the one they sing along to out of all the songs. And I think, oh my God, like, from then to now, young people are resonating with it. So that's amazing.
I'm taking off my earrings because I'm nodding so much in agreement with you, Jenny, that I'm making noise on my headphones. So.
Jangles.
Well, as I mentioned, I mean, obviously Running Up That Hill is what's put Kate on the radar for a lot of people, a lot of young people right now. But you, Jenny, mentioned The Dreaming. And one of the reasons I invited Anne to be on the show was, as I mentioned, the NPR essay, How Kate Bush's The Dreaming Made My Monsters My Own. And for a lot of super fans of Kate, The Dreaming is the album. And or at least the album. And for, you know, obviously a lot of people would argue her least commercially accessible album, her weirdest album. But I'd love to start talking about why that album. And also, I'm curious your thoughts, like if there is someone who only knew Kate Bush from Stranger Things, right? That hill, how are they going to react if they put The Dreaming on? You know what I mean? Are they going to dig it? Are they going to be open minded to it? They're going to be like, what the hell is this? So, yeah, let's talk about that album a bit.
Yeah, I mean, Kate Bush herself called The Dreaming her mad album. And Jenny, it's exciting to me that you also felt that album so strongly when you first heard it. For me, it was an absolute revelation. You know, it was beyond the bounds of what I thought pop music could do. And I mean, I was like that new wave punk girl who, you know, fashion was new wave, aggressiveness was in my heart was punk. So it's not like I hadn't heard wild music. And in fact, I remember when I found Kate's music, not The Dreaming, at first at a church rummage sale, and some DJ in Seattle, Washington, where I grew up, was selling their records at this church rummage sale, jumble sale. And I bought that record and the Susie and the Banshees first record. It was sort of like two rows diverge in a yellow wood. Do I go to the light? Do I go to the dark? I have to say I went to the light. But that wildness of those early records, I think it's perfect for now, for young people today whose identities are really fluid, who are daring to be themselves in ways that I think it was harder to do publicly in the 80s. So I just feel like The Dreaming is actually the perfect soundtrack to 2022.
Oh, I couldn't agree with you like more, you know, The Dreaming. But I say for 2022, for me, it's kind of every single year of my life, you know.
album,
kind of, it comes to you. I think it comes to you more times, and sometimes it is like a calling. And I don't know whether it's that kind of, it almost has, obviously it has that spiritualistic, the ritualistic side and the element of to it, but the way that it crashes with the synthesizers, like I said before, that sound that people are searching for now, I think music has changed so much that it's kind of come back to itself, and young people are searching for this new kind of sound. And then if you kind of go back to the innovators, you know, like Kate, who kind of a really innovated sound and how you can listen to it, how you can make a pop song, how you can do a song with donkey calls, you know, people, that's it's like, I can't quite think of like a more simplistic joy than hearing Kate or a Kate song when she's shrilling away or doing a donkey call or howling. It's that kind of freedom and fun. But it's not just that side as well. You can get the fun and the freedom in her lyrics and the way she talks. I was listening to recently her cover of Sexual Healing, which is kind of the way she sings it, the way she moves her mouth during it, you know, it's so playful, it's so sensual. It's not just these kind of shrieking sounds. It's the way they play with all of those sounds.
We're talking about an artist who found sensuality and playfulness in doing the laundry when she recorded Mrs. Bartolozzi yeah, for exactly. Ariel. So yes, Kate enchants everything, I think.
Yeah. All our dirty clothes that hadn't gone into the wash, and all your shirts and jeans and things, put them in the.
But I'm so glad you mentioned the synthesizer because, of course, The Dreaming was the first record she wrote entirely on the Fairlight CMI, which was the first digital workstation that had a sampler built in. So as hip hop was beginning to really take hold in the States, here's Kate making a record that could take any sound and incorporate it, you know, shattering glass or didgeridoos, or as you said, you know, her crazy vocals where she's every, I think Get Out of My House needs a revival because we all want to talk about the braying like a donkey. But I mean, the importance of the Fairlight cannot be underestimated. And that also parallels how music is made today. And Ginny, I'm sure you could speak to this. You know, music makers have taken hold and charge of their own process using technology. And she was a pioneer of that.
Yeah, Ginny, I wanted to piggyback onto Anne's question. You make music, electronic-based music. How does the influence of Kate factor into that?
Well, I always like to call myself the Kate Bush of drag, you know, because I like to highly flatter myself at all times. and I think that's the reason of the idea of creating music and performance for me, that the elements that kind of, the two kind of go together, but the two clash at the same time, you know. So I've always liked the private side that Kate has with her private life and making the music. And there's a quintessential Britishness as well of, you know, like doing a love song to laundry. You know, there's kind of the mundane things. It's kind of being domestic and being hidden away and being private and writing these things. And I think, you know, we all sit and play with our phones and we all sit and flick as much as we can through every single thing that we can digest. So if we can sit and glitch around and play with music and go, oh, well, this is fun. And it's kind of more accessible than sitting at a piano or a guitar. You can, you know, kids today, people like myself, anybody, anyone that can flick a phone can create music, basically. Mm-hmm. So creating electronic music in your own domesticity, that's the kind of essence, if that makes any sense at all, that's the essence of which I like. And then thinking about that and going out and being very performative with it and then seeing how you can do, you think of Kate as a performer from her last live shows Before the Dawn, and you look at the way that it was performed, you know, and especially the Ninth Wave was given over to such a performance level. The music was there, so you're able to do that thing kind of privately and, you know, almost kind of do your geeky bits at home. And so the idea of before that, Kate was kind of playing with a synthesizer and smashing things and crumpling bits and things to create that. Now we're here kind of at home playing with all of our gadgets and gizmos.
Ginny, did you go? I went to the very last night of the Before the Dawn residency. I am the kind of person that will get on a plane to go to concerts. And I absolutely knew if I wanted to ever see Kate Bush in my lifetime, I needed to go to her. I needed to fly to her. It was like her first performances since 1979. This is not an artist that's going to headline Coachella or anything or Glastonbury.
No, so, sadly.
Sadly, I mean, I hope for it every year. So I went out. I went on the last night, which I believe was I think it was October 1st of 2014. You know, she did something like 30 dates at the Hammersmith. And I mean, I was crying pretty much the minute she got on stage. Did either of you go out there to any of those shows?
Sadly, I regret I did not jump on the plane. So I did not. Did you, Ginny?
Well, I mean, in that case, Anne, I went twice. So I went for you as well. I was very lucky
you.
To be able to go twice.
I can feel it. I can feel the osmosis. You're sending me the experience.
Yeah, exactly.
Didn't you propose to your husband at one of the shows or something?
Oh, yeah, that's right. That is correct. Well, I think it's always good that I saw her twice because I did. I've been with my husband now for, we've been together 16 years. So when I proposed, I was like, hey, it's about time I proposed. And I wanted to do it. During the whole show, I thought, okay, this is a once in a lifetime opportunity. But then it's like, well, I don't really want to like distract from Kate. So, you know, I kept putting it off and putting it off. And then I thought, well, I'll do it during his favorite song. And then I thought, well, no, because that would ruin the favorite song. So you kept going. And it was right at the end when doing the encore of Cloud Busting, and I got down and proposed. So,
how could he say no? How could he say no?
Exactly, exactly. That would be very difficult. So it wasn't until the next time that I could kind of fully watch and enjoy the show. And I always remember this. This is my kind of claim to fame. I remember we were sat on like the third row from the front on the second time. We were very blessed. And PJ Harvey was sat behind me. And I always remember PJ Harvey there with a notebook.
Oh my gosh.
You know, that kind of summed it up for me. It was like a call, like a spiritual call to go see our goddess and take note, you know, like she is speaking, like what has she said to the nation, like what, how can we do better as performers and writers, and you know, because you list the names of people that were there. I think Grace Jones was there.
Grace Jones was on my show. I know that not at my show. Actually, David Gilmour, who of course famously was there from the start with Kate Bush producer demo, David Gilmour was at my night because it was the last night. I know Grace Jones was there. Not the night I was there, but one of the other nights, Big Boy was there. And, you know, I've always entertained, and my heart is full with how much Big Boy loves Kate Bush. And apparently when he went out to that show, they ended up having dinner together. And the rumor is that there's it's not a rumor, it's happening. There is a duet between Big Boy and Kate Bush.
Oh, yeah.
Very excited. Like, why isn't he releasing it right now? But hopefully, you know, soon. But, you know, yeah, everybody wanted to go to that show. Everybody flew out to that show. And I love that PJ Harvey story, Jenny, because I actually have a list, you know, at some point I wanted in this conversation to kind of, so we might as well do it now, Kate's legacy and newer artists. And I had Bjork, I had Tori Amos, which is obvious, and Florence and the Machine, Goldfrapp, Sinead O'Connor, St. Vincent, Grimes, FKA Twigs, Banks, Karen O, and I had PJ Harvey down on that list. So, Anne, I would love, because you've written so many books about women in music and stuff, can you talk a little bit about how Kate's legacy, I've obviously listed a bunch of ours, but you could probably more eloquently talk about what it is that resonates with younger women today.
Well, I think it's women and men and people of all genders who love the freedom Kate presented to us, Kate enacted, to be able to move from one identity to another, you know, and this highly theatrical music that also is so feelingful, you know, and so that's the thing that I think is very profound about her. One of the many things very profound about her music is here is music that is just high glam, very art rock, but its essence are those little moments of I'm in the battlefield and I have to make a decision, or I've lost someone I love and this is how it feels, or I don't know, I am some kind of creature, perhaps not even human, but I still am going through my feelings, you know, and that I see everywhere. It's hard to separate Kate's influence from the influence of people like David Bowie, I think, you know, but I think she should be held up. Oh, I was going to say next to David Bowie. Maybe that's a little bit nuts because Bowie.
I mean, if anyone can be, it would be her.
Let's just say, you know, to use some possibly stale Christian metaphors, if Bowie is the Old Testament, Kate is the New Testament. You know, she brought forward that legacy, and I think any kind of artist who plays with persona, who plays with multiple vocalities, she is part of what they are tapping into. So, you know, I'd even say R&B artists like, I don't know, Raven Lenae, for example, might be taken from her. You know, there's so much, or Solange or something, you know.
Solange actually covered Cloud Busting at Coachella once. I was there.
Right. So there you go. I think she's the go-to to kind of think about how the theatrical, the high concept relates to the emotional and the heart.
And of course, if you're talking R&B, I mean, what is arguably the most successful Kate Bush cover? It's Maxwell. Woman's Work. I mean, I actually, you know, when we're talking about men, there's, you know, a lot of people. I remember when the Stranger Things thing came out, there were a lot of, I guess, probably millennial age people now who were saying that their introduction to Running Up That Hill had been Placebo's cover, which is actually excellent. And then I do want to give a shout out to the Future Heads, because I don't think their Hounds of Love cover got enough love at the time. I thought that was a really good cover. And interestingly, I did want to talk about the fact that, you know, Kate Bush has been up for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame twice. I do kind of, she's been nominated, not inducted. And I kind of feel like if this Stranger Thing phenomenon had happened just a few months or weeks earlier, the vote might have gone a different way. But yeah, to talk about other covers, I think it's really interesting that Pat Benatar, who is getting in this year, she, you know, did a cover of Wuthering Heights. And yeah, I kind of think that when Pat does the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, I feel like she should cover that song at the ceremony to sort of give a nod. Because when I was voting, I was really like, do I go Pat? Do I go Kate? You know, but I think it's really great. So do you have any covers that either of you want to mention that I haven't already mentioned or that you want to expound upon?
I do have a couple covers. First of all, there's a wonderful album came out, I don't know, maybe 8 years ago by a jazz singer named Theo Bleckman, German born, I believe, lives in New York, amazing voice, really interesting thinker. And Theo did an entire album of Kate covers. It's called Hello Earth. It's really beautiful. Theo trained with Meredith Monk and is a, you know, a great avant-garde vocalist. So to hear Theo's voice with Kate's song, that's one of my favorites. But I also want to mention Cecile McLaurin-Salvant, another groundbreaking jazz vocalist. And on Cecile's latest record, she covers Wuthering Heights. And she also has this amazing theater work called I can't pronounce it right. Sorry, my French is bad. La Ogresse. It's the ogre, the woman ogre. Very much inspired by Kate. So you see Kate influencing the jazz world as well as every other one.
It's hard because the covers that I do tend to be glorified cabaret, kind of glorified karaoke. But if I was going to be covering something, I'd take a lot more kind of in-depth time to think about things, because I always find covering people that you love is much harder. You know, it's much easier for songs that you don't know that well to kind of deconstruct. But trying to cover Kate for me is a bit too close for home sometimes. So I'm like, oh, no, I can't do it. But I tell you who did do a beautiful cover of Cloudbusting. I did a podcast recently with Chesney Hawkes, of the one and only Chesney Hawkes. And they did a cover for me. They're a friend of mine. They wanted to do a cover of one of my favourite songs. So they did Cloudbusting. And he's only played it once or twice. And I keep saying, Ches, you need to play this live, because it's really, really gorgeous. And another one, it's a very strange one, but I literally just typed in onto YouTube. I was like, Kate Bush cover Breathing. And there's this one person, this one random video. I can't think of the artist's name. And they've just released a cover of Breathing. And it's kind of vocal, loopy, it's definitely a take on the original. And I thought it was really interesting, but I cannot find anything else. I don't know the artist's name. But if you type Kate Bush cover Breathing and search that, and I thought, oh, more stuff like that, you know, I want to hear more kind of interesting covers, not just kind of formulaic, this is my favorite song, so I'm singing this woman's word to make you cry. I'm like, no, come on, let's unpick Sat in Your Lap. Let's do that and do that on some accordions or something. Let's go wild.
That would be a challenging that one to cover, I feel like.
Didn't she get inspired by Stevie Wonder on that song? Wasn't that a Stevie Wonder?
Yes.
You mentioned The Fairlight earlier.
Yes. Yeah, she came home from a Stevie Wonder concert and made that song. Just the construction of that song is so, it's just so, this is like, it's like a magic castle. I'd love to hear a great cover of that song. Oh, we should shout out Halsey too, who of course, after the Stranger Things moment, was covering Running Up That Hill in concert, and I think talking a lot about Kate's influence. I think Halsey's a great example of a pop artist right now who, you know, who took from Kate both the challenge to be yourself and then also the idea that you can be making quote unquote mainstream pop, whatever that is also avant-garde, you know. And Halsey, of course, also working with our friends, the Nine Inch Nails crew. They're totally 80s and they're totally 90s. So there you go.
There you go. Well, Ginny, well, I mentioned at the top of this podcast that I first, obviously, as most people did, became aware of your Kate fandom because of you dressing as Kate on the first episode, one of the greatest runway challenges in Drag Race history, which was the British Gay Icon Challenge. And there were people dressed as Boy George and David Bowie and Naomi Campbell, and it was, and Princess Julia. I mean, it was so great. I was just in heaven. But I'm very curious about, obviously, I know why you chose Kate because you're a fan, but what makes her a British gay icon, queer icon for you? Why did you choose her for that challenge?
I think Anne mentioned it before, previously. It's this idea of the theatrical and this kind of gender-defying theatrics as well. The songs that are written are not just from one perspective. They can be seen from many perspectives. So for drag, and on a performative level, it's gold, you know, it's gold dust for Kate's songs, because we can perform them, create them, costume them, choreograph them to really create a world. And that's what's amazing about Kate's music and why that and drag really works together. For me, it was very important to represent to Kate. It was also a very easy dress up gig. You know, it was cheap, it was quick. I just get myself a red dress and a big fluffy wig and some, you know, it was great. And that was the one thing I wanted to kind of introduce people who hadn't seen Kate before. So one of my huge reasons to go on to Drag Race was that I'm not kind of like all the other drag queens. You know, my influences are completely different. I worship at the altar of kind of Kate Bush, Tori Amos, you know, those are my idols. It's not these other fierce idols. So I wanted to bring that element to drag. So to do that look, and especially the Wuthering Heights red dress look, it's an iconic look. You can't help but resonate with that look. However, if I was to do it again, I'd probably want to do something a bit more of a Kate fandom look. And that's where things get more interesting. I'd love to do, you know, the big velvet hat for the Sensual World video. We've mentioned it before. But, oh, no, the suspended in gaffer with the grey boiler suit and with all the sand. I mean, those looks would be ideal, but they wouldn't quite read, I think, for a novice.
Right, well, when you came out, we knew exactly what you were referencing, which was why it was so perfect.
To me, my favorite image of Kate from that time when I was first discovering her is her in the bat wings, you know, those pictures of her in the bat wings. And the thing that makes it is her face. You know, she has this look on her face, like she has transformed into that creature. And then, of course, I also like the lion costume on Lionheart, but that's for the furries in the crowd. This is the Kate furry moment.
Since we're talking about Wuthering Heights and Britain and Kate cosplay, Jenny, have you ever been to this thing called the most Wuthering Heights day ever? It's some kind of like festival where everybody dresses up like how you did on Drag Race as Kate, and they like run around a maypole somewhere in England. Do you know what I'm talking about?
I have seen it, but I haven't seen a maypole of it.
Envisioning that. But they're in a field and there's frolicking.
They do the Wuthering Heights dance is what they do.
I just envisioned a maypole just to make it more festive.
Do that. We could start. Yes. But, you know, we could do the religion of, you know, the gospel of the dreaming and just focus on that. And we can have a maypole there or something.
Absolutely.
Be the MC of that.
It could be like Midsummer, but less bloody, or maybe as bloody. Well,
I agree with that. I always say that Midsummer was the most hilarious film I've ever watched. So that soundtrack with the dreaming could be, you know, absolute pure joy.
I think we're on to something here. I think we'll need to take that conversation offline and have a meeting. Well, obviously, we've just begun to unpack all things Kate Bush. So this is going to have to be a two-parter. So can I please ask you, Anne and Jenny, if you can come back again to continue this discussion?
Of course, of course.
Absolutely, I'm in.
Awesome. I am in as well. Thank you, Anne and Jenny. We'll be back later. I'm Lindsay Parker. Thanks for listening. Part two is coming up. And remember to give Totally 80s a rate and review on your favorite podcast platform.
This was Totally 80s, the podcast dedicated to the music of the greatest decade ever. Don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Totally 80s, and please leave us a review on your favorite podcast platform. Until our next episode, catch you on the flip side.